Welcome to the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Ahead this hour, the pandemic has led to a huge increase in the number of people who are food insecure. We'll talk about how local food banks are reacting, even as fewer individuals are able to donate. Also, Hanukkah begins in just a few days. Rabbi Yosef Goldman will join us. We'll talk about observing the holiday during a tumultuous year. And also, Rabbi Goldman is a musician and co-founder of the Rising Song record label. We'll listen to some of his work. But to begin, we turn our attention to Bensalem, Bucks County, the focus of a new pilot program in which two social workers will soon join the local police force. Trained in crisis intervention, the co-responders will go out on calls that are likely to involve mental health issues in an attempt to help de-escalate potentially volatile situations and avert violence, a subject which gained national attention in October when 27-year-old Walter Wallace Jr. was shot and killed by Philadelphia police while having what appeared to be a mental health breakdown. WHYY's Katie Meyer has been looking into the new Bucks County program, and she's here with us now with details. Hi, Katie.
Hello.
Well, why did Bucks County decide to launch this program now, and why start with Bensalem?
Yeah, good question. I mean, I think this is something that a lot of municipalities have started to think about in the wake of the Walter Wallace shooting and also George Floyd's death back in May. You know, there was a national outcry about how police handle mental health situations and how they handle situations that don't need to be violent or probably do not need to be violent. You know, a whole, you know, conversation about de-escalation, basically. And so Bucks County, Matt Weintraub, the district attorney who's been involved in this, he says he got the idea from a pretty similar program that Dauphin County piloted sort of in and around Harrisburg. And so they are just kind of, you know, throwing their hat in, seeing how this goes. And they had the reason it's happening now was they had some money in their budget that they found for it. So there's going to be $200,000 that go every year for 2 years to see how this goes.
So say there's a 911 call and the subject is deemed to be struggling with a mental health break. What is the overall objective of the social workers present? What are they hoping for in the outcome?
Basically, you know, avoid violence, de-escalate, keep the person out of jail. You know, the idea here is that people having a mental health crisis often, you know, cannot respond in a way that the police are asking them to. So, you know, get on the ground. You know, if they're holding, for instance, a knife like Walter Wallace was, you know, there can just be a real disconnect with, you know, what is seen as the rational thing to do in that situation and what this person is going to be willing or able to do. And so, you know, the objective, again, is these people are trained in crisis intervention. They hopefully would be able to talk this person down. And so, you know, again, it's a new program, so it's all sort of hypothetical at this point. They've got some data to work off of and some other programs that have been done in similar ways. But I do think I got the sense that it's going to be sort of a, well, you know, we're going to figure it out a little bit as we go along.
Okay. Well, Philadelphia has crisis response workers on staff to assist in 911 calls like the one that ended in the death of Walter Wallace. There was, however, no crisis response person available at the time of the Wallace call. Katie, in Bensalem, we're talking about just two social workers to coordinate with police. So what sort of coverage will be available?
Yeah, and that was one of my big questions, too. And when I asked, they essentially said, yes, this is a limited program. They're not going to be able to go on every call. So they've taken a couple of steps to try to use them, I think, to their best effect. They have a list of people in Bensalem. You know, Bensalem's not huge. And so they've got a list of people who have mental health issues that are known and known to police who they, you know, often have to respond to relatively frequently. And so those calls are going to be sort of the top priority for those people. I also, you know, they basically say, like, you know, if there is a, you know, a case and there's someone we don't know and it turns out to be a mental health issue, we can then call them. And, you know, the crisis responders, the social workers can come. But also some of it's going to be just like them reviewing the cases that they were not at because they're not going to be working 24 hours a day.
Yeah.
So, you know, sometimes there's going to be a case that they just aren't going to be able to go to, but they will be able to review it and give feedback to the officers who were there.
Policing is, you know, it's obviously dangerous work at times. Are there concerns for the safety of these social workers, Walter Bynum and I guess it's Rachel Augusto?
Mm-hmm. Yep. And yeah, so these two people, I mean, we got to talk to the social workers themselves, and both of them, they are trained in crisis intervention, so this isn't totally foreign territory to either of them. But yeah, I got the sense, you know, especially from Fred Herron, who's the director of public safety in Bensalem, he was sort of like, yeah, and we're going to just pray nothing bad happens. Because that is, you know, that's their worst case scenario here. They're taking several kind of concrete steps to make sure things are going to be safe. There's going to be bulletproof vests available to these social workers, for instance. And, you know, they made it pretty clear, you know, their safety is going to be the top priority in all this. But again, it's funny, like the police, this is a new thing for them. And, you know, they're all, they, you know, the officials, the directors in charge, so the police officers are kind of excited about this. They're looking forward to it. But they seemed more worried than the social workers themselves did.
Okay. And as you mentioned earlier, the program, members of the program are going to probably be figuring it out somewhat as they go along. So are Bynum and Agosto optimistic about the potential for success in their new role partnering with Bensalem police officers?
Yeah, to the extent that I was able to talk to them, yes, they do. I mean, again, this is work that they're comfortable with, that they've done for a long time. And so they both said, yeah, we expect that this is going to go well, and we're looking forward to partnering with the police.
You mentioned earlier, too, that Bucks County's district attorney, Matt Weintraub, was looking, I guess, to Dauphin County because they have a similar program in place. Do we know to what degree Dauphin County has been successful with this, Katie?
You know, I don't cover it very closely. To the extent that I was able to see, this is, again, sort of a limited program along the same lines as Bucks County, but I haven't seen any major problems arise from it, so I think that's always a good sign.
In an age in which there are calls to defund or reshape policing, District Attorney Matt Weintraub is reluctant to put a label on this program. Why is that?
Yeah, that was something that, you know, Weintraub made clear. That was something that the Bensalem's mayor, Jody Girolamo, made very clear. They didn't want to say this is a defund the police scenario here. And the reason for that is that's a political issue. You know, any sort of changing to policing is political. And so I think what you've seen as part of the defund the police movement is a move to bring in social workers to make sure that mental health cases are not just handled by police officers. So, you know, it's not far away from that, but they're saying, no, we are giving additional resources to the police. This is not a defund thing. This is just making sure everybody, you know, is doing the job that they're trained for. And again, so this, I mean, Bucks County, a relatively politically moderate county of the Philly collar counties, it's one of the more conservative. And they, you know, there's a lot of Republicans in Bensalem still. And so, again, moderate Republicans. So I think what they were trying to do was communicate to their constituents here, you know, this is not radical. This is just, you know, a pilot that we are trying to give a couple more resources to our police department.
Supportive of police. Okay. Mm-hmm. So what? Look, $400,000 over 2 years cost to the program. Was this a stretch to get this money?
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the things that I thought was interesting because, you know, especially right now during the pandemic, not everybody just has $400,000 in the couch cushions they can shake out. But this came from block grants that the county gets from the state. So basically, you know, there's mental health grants that they can pretty much use for whatever they want. And so they had this money. It was available. And they said, you know, and I talked to some of the county commissioners who were, you know, always thinking about funding and how to keep it going. And they said, yes, we are able and willing to put this money towards this program right now. And if it works well and we want to expand it, we're going to do our very best to make sure we can continue sustaining it going forward. So,
okay.
You know, again, it's not nothing, but they said that they are, you know, pretty well able to cover it for now.
Yeah, sounds as if there's a hope that they might make this permanent down the road if it works
out.
Yes,
absolutely. That's the intention that I saw from everybody.
Okay, Katie Meyer, quickly to some other news you've been following. It's been well over a week since President-elect Joe Biden was certified as the winner of Pennsylvania. However, this hasn't stopped President Trump's campaign and allies from continuing to challenge the results. Bring us up to speed on what some GOP members of the state legislature are attempting with something called the 1887 Electoral Count Act.
Yes. So they did this late on Friday, which is always my favorite time for anybody to make news. So, yes, it was a big group of GOP House members and seven Republican senators who sent a letter to every member of Pennsylvania's congressional delegation, basically asking them to, you know, object and vote to sustain such an objection to the Electoral College votes from Pennsylvania. The really significant thing about this was that Republican House leaders, Brian Cutler and Kerry Benninghoff, signed on to this. Usually they were kind of keeping themselves out of any real attempts to overturn the count or to question the results, but they threw their hats into this one. So basically, this Electoral Count Act from 1887 is notoriously confusing, but essentially, you know, the first step of election certification is it's electors cast their ballots after states certify their votes. Biden has more than Trump by a lot, but that's going to happen on December 14th. Mm-hmm. But then Congress has to certify the results. And so the Electoral Count Act basically gives Congress a way to weigh in on a contested result. And, you know, they vote about the results from a state where it's contested. And if they disagree, it's kind of unclear what happens, but it could fall to the contested state's governor to decide the slate of electors. So anyway, this is a last-ditch attempt, basically, that, you know, the Republicans in Harrisburg don't have any power to make this happen, but they want Congress to do it. Unclear if it's going to happen. You know, this has never been used to overturn results in a state before, and it's been around, again, since 1887. Mm. So it's a long shot, but I think it's a real statement of values from Pennsylvania Republicans.
Yeah. And as with some of the other attempts, or most of the other attempts, if not all of the other attempts, kind of the longest of long shots. Okay. And on a completely different track, from now through March, Katie, a number of Philly's parks are off limits during the overnight hours because of efforts to cull the deer population. This is something that apparently happens every year?
Yes, it is. That's the deep cut story. This was one of the ones I did over Thanksgiving. I always think this is so interesting. Philly has, you know, parks with wild animals in it living in the city. And so every year they've been doing this for decades now. They go out and, you know, they try to make it kind of euphemistic, but really they shoot deer. And it's done by biologists. It's done by professional sharpshooters. And it's done so that deer don't, you know, first of all, unbalance the, you know, biodiversity in the forest that we have in Philly. And also so they don't run into the road and get hit by cars, because that can be a real big problem. So, yes, you know, this is something that some environmental groups have objected to over the years, but it's relatively standard, you know, forest management, especially around a place where a lot of people live. Sure. So the parks are going to be closing early for this to happen. They kind of try to do it away from people as much as they possibly can. You know, you don't want people in and around the parks when sharpshooting is going on.
Yeah.
So, yep, that's going to go through most of the winter.
So quickly, what happens to the deer carcasses?
They are removed. There's been some reporting in the past about what happens with them, but I think they're just kind of shipped out. And the meat actually goes to food banks. So they're kind of processed, broken down, and processed for eating.
All right. Well, Katie Meyer, thank you so much. Always a pleasure. Great to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Katie Meyer is a WHYY reporter, often, for the most part, actually covering political events. And speaking of food that goes to food banks, we're going to be talking with the leaders of two food banks next on the Roundup. Because of the continuing pandemic and economic shutdown and how all that's affecting our area, there is increasing food insecurity. Be sure to stay with us for that. And then at the end of the show, we talk about Hanukkah. It's all coming up on the Roundup.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. The holidays can be an especially challenging time for those who live in poverty, but this year the need for food and other basics is skyrocketing among the poor and many who find themselves newly unemployed due to the pandemic. Local food bank organizations are seeing record numbers of people in need, and exacerbating the problem, donations aren't keeping pace with demand. We're going to discuss the reasons why, how food banks are reacting and coping as they try to provide meals for tens of thousands of impoverished families, and what any of us can do to help. If you'd like to join the conversation, lines are open, 888-477-9499. Send an email to radiotimes@whyy.org if you like, or you can tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. We have two guests for this part of the Roundup. George Matisik is Executive Director of the Share Food Program, which serves the Philadelphia region. Welcome, George.
Good morning, Mary.
And Gerald Davis is Executive Director of the Touch New Jersey Food Alliance. Touch New Jersey provides for Camden and the greater South Jersey area. Hello, Gerald.
Good morning, Mary.
Good morning to both. So let's get right to it and talk about the demand for food. George, first to you, give us an estimate. How many people are being served by the Share Food Program, say, every month?
Right now, so at a monthly rate right now, we're serving about 1 million unique individuals per month. And that's up from about 700,000 prior to COVID. And we're seeing that all across the region in, frankly, in areas where we never saw it before. So it's not only is the issue deepening, but it's also widening into communities that haven't had multi-generational poverty.
And Gerald Davis, what are the numbers for Touch New Jersey Food Alliance? And also, are you seeing food insecurity in areas where it didn't exist on a large scale, say, last year?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there's a new dynamic out there. And typically, prior to pandemic, we would open the doors on a Tuesday or Wednesday. There's a full feeding day, and there would be 250, 300 people in the street. There's now 1,000 or 1,500 people in the street. And some of them are driving pretty nice cars. So there is a new dynamic in that regard. So our numbers are in the area of about $500,000, 500,000 people per month.
Yeah. George Matisik, what are you hearing from those who are food insecure, their stories?
Yeah, I think, you know, for so many people, they are turning to Share Food Program for the first time in their lives. And so a lot of folks are deeply concerned. You know, it's been a lot of concerns, A, around the SNAP benefits over the last couple of years, but in particular the last 9 months, and a fear that SNAP benefits were going to go away for a while, with more and more people needing to find out where they can go to turn to get food. And many pantries at the beginning of the pandemic, many smaller food pantries did close at the beginning of the pandemic. Mm. We worked with hundreds of them in the region to get folks reopened and created 40 sites with the city of Philadelphia in particular where folks could go to get boxes of food. So we've been able to keep food going at record numbers, but there was still some deep concern out there from residents who didn't know where to go and were fearful during this period that there wouldn't be enough food for those who are food insecure.
Gerald Davis, how is the need impacting the Touch Food Alliance of New Jersey?
Well,
and your operations.
Interesting. There's a challenge. There's always a challenge, as George was saying, and people are on a regular basis are looking for places to go, and smaller pantries, again, as mentioned, just aren't able to compete and provide the products necessary in order to help people. But, you know, as we do in our society, the American way is always to step forward and meet challenges. There are an unbelievable amount of individuals and organizations. In our particular case, Mary, places like the South Jersey Food Bank and Freeholders of Camden County, Congressman George Norcross's office, and most especially for us is Philabundance. They step forward. They provide those things that are necessary, and it remains the challenge for us to be able to logistically get it there to the people because the need just doesn't stop.
Well, talk about the logistics. Do you need to get more people on staff? Do you need to work longer hours? Do you need to have find more resources and in order to be able to get food to those who need it, the increasing number of people?
I think all of those are endemic to what we're doing, but most importantly for us is logistics, across the board is logistics, because people are limited in what they can do access-wise. We have a separate database of shut-ins, people who simply can't get out. They don't have assistance to do that. And number one is finding them and making sure that you can address them. Number two is getting it to them. So logistics is the biggest thing that challenges us.
George, let's hear from you on this, the logistics and whether you feel you are able to get to those who can't get to you.
Yeah, well, absolutely. I mean, the first thing you have to remember is March 11th was the day when kind of the world changed. And that was the Wednesday when the NBA announced it was cutting down the season and mm-hmm. President Trump announced the European travel ban. And that day, the entire food system changed overnight. And everybody's supermarket sales the next day went up 86%. And everybody basically built a food pantry in their basement. And so all of the dry and shelf-stable product that food banks so typically rely on was suddenly just sucked out of the system. And many food banks, including Share Food Program, we had to pivot really quickly in order to find new ways to supply this growing, unprecedented demand that we've never seen before. So we had to do, we were very fortunate, we did a $1.3 million buy in late February in preparation for this. We never would have been able to get through this if we wouldn't, hadn't been preparing for this for weeks ahead of time.
So if people want to donate, I'm guessing non-perishables are the best items to donate if you're donating food. And so that's part one. And part two, George, do you feel that you were able to get enough to you know, send out to pantries so that the need is being taken care of?
At no point during the pandemic have we had a shortage of food. We've been able to keep supplies going, but that's only because of the generosity of donors to us, both food donors and monetary donors.
Yeah. Well, and Gerald, to you, Gerald Davis of the Touch Food Alliance, I've also been reading that there is a declining number of people who are able to donate. How is this affecting your organization?
It's for sure. I think a lot of people have stepped forward and done the best that they can. But remember, the government did jump in here to a lot of people's advantage. They ran the CFAP program that put a lot of produce and nutrition in boxes. We were in the area of 24 pallets a day of donating out just from the CFAP program, which totaled a little over 3 million pounds in the summertime alone that we were able to get out there from geography as far north as Paterson, New Jersey, down to Cape May. So, yeah, the individuals, it is limited, and they are hard-pressed because, you know, survival is the first thing, and people are dealing with that. But there are organizations that step forward. We're in a position where we have, in many cases, a surplus of food. It's about logistics, again, for us, and that is getting it out to the right people for the right reasons.
We have, you know, this is going to be a while before this is resolved. I believe, George, that you had been talking to our producer, John Ahrens, who said, and you told him that even if the health crisis were to subside tomorrow, and it's going to be months, the economic crisis will last for a long time, meaning increasing food insecurity is here for the foreseeable future, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. Look at all the disruptions that this has caused that are going to have long-term effects. And, you know, frankly, one of the ways that we're seeing that bear out is that we're seeing, as I mentioned earlier, we're seeing this need in areas where we never saw it before. A perfect example is the East Passyunk neighborhood, which most people would think of as sort of a, you know, gentrified neighborhood and economically stable. But there's a lot of restaurant workers who live in that community. And so when we worked with the city of Philadelphia to establish those 40 sites, one of them was at an East Passyunk Recreation Center, and we were distributing 400 boxes in less than 30 minutes. So we are seeing this all across the city and region, and really that we're not seeing this go down in any way right now. If anything, it's only continuing to increase the amount of need that's out there.
Can your organization keep the pace of giving up?
We have to. I mean, going into the holidays, we're certainly hoping that, you know, we've been able to step forward for our city and our region, and we're hoping that donors will continue to support organizations like the Share Food Program and like Touch New Jersey to keep this work going.
And Gerald Davis, I'll ask the same question of you for the Touch Food Alliance. You know, next few months, can you keep this intense pace going?
It's a new normal. Is what it comes down to. On a regular basis, we were doing three full days a week, and it was a little bit lackadaisical on the third day. You know what? We can not get it all out in 5 days now. So the question of whether we have to can proceed is that we have to proceed. Thank God we have sources for food. As George says, getting it to the right people is important, and the importance is the food that I get today, I need to get out today because there's going to be more behind it tomorrow. And I know that works and flies in the face of shortages in numerous areas. I've seen unbelievable stories in New York about people standing in line for hours and hours. Sure. You know, thanks to George's organization, many, many other small ones, the places in New Jersey, South Jersey Food Bank, Philabundance, there's food available, but I'm not sure that we were set up with the right systems in order to be able to get that out of there before this, and we're certainly being tested now.
Speaking of Philabundance, it was the victim of quite a cyber attack recently. The organization was scammed out of nearly $1 million. Was this a real eye-opener for the food relief community at George Matusik?
Yeah, you know, we certainly continue to monitor issues like that. And, you know, shared food program, we definitely place a high emphasis on security for first of all, for our donors and everybody who donates to us, as well as having the proper internal controls. But it's certainly was an eye opener, I think, for a lot of folks.
And Gerald Davis, have you found your organization has had to perhaps look at new cyber safeguards?
Yeah, for sure. It would make us and did make us do some reinspection on our own, check our insurance coverages and things like that, look at our personnel, look at qualifications, and look at the potential threat that, unfortunately, Phil Abundance was a victim of.
Kathy Fisher of the Greater Philadelphia Coalition Against Hunger is quoted in The Inquirer as saying, when it comes to feeding the hungry, food banks have too large a role. Quote, we should be addressing income inequality and getting people jobs with sustaining wages, end quote. George Matisik, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, Kathy's absolutely right. You know, the issue is that food banks can never actually have an impact on the poverty rate itself. But what we can do is help relieve poverty for today. So as long as we're living in the times that we're living in, food banks are necessary. And we need to continue to invest in this infrastructure because we don't have other means right now, you know, hopefully with new administrations and we can do this through Congress and Washington, we'll be able to make some of those improvements. But we certainly right now we have to rely heavily on food banks like the Share Food Program in Philadelphia and Touch Food Alliance in New Jersey.
And Gerald, I'll get this next question to you. There are so many pressing needs right now. Might the safety net provided by food banks be unintentionally pushing, you know, issues around income inequality to a back burner?
You know, anybody, and George will tell you this too, is anybody gets involved in this and works on the street with people is constantly torn between the good that we do and the potential for entitlement. And it's always a back and forth argument. What we do is valuable and necessary. But we, quite frankly, I would rather not have permanent customers. I'd rather they move on into employment, be able to afford food themselves, and then help others. But it is something, this is just not the time to address that, unfortunately. This is where we need to go. We need to continue to help people. Yeah. So, you know, when the veil is lifted, you know, we can consider quality control like that again and we can think about people. But right now, it's about getting it to them.
George, it sounds like you want to jump in.
I'm disagreeing with that. And certainly, you know, one of the things that we can do as food banks, though, is help connect with organizations who have some of those wraparound services, who have access to job opportunities and other benefits that can help move people out of poverty. And so that's, you know, that's one of the tasks that we've taken on at the Share Food Program is to help find those partners. So when we're distributing food, it's a gateway to those other programs and services that folks can get to help get out of poverty.
And also, I guess what I meant by that question was, you know, perhaps members of Congress who have so much to consider right now with pandemic relief, if they're thinking, okay, food banks are taking care of this part of the equation, we can think of income inequality later on. That's what I meant, you know, as opposed to considering this right now and helping people to move forward and be able to, you know, get jobs and self-support, et cetera. That's what I meant by that. So,
yeah.
Okay. So when it comes to actual donations, which is preferable, food or money, and why? Gerald Davis?
Boy, depends on the individual organization as to how they handle. In both cases, there's no nonprofit out there doing what we're doing who doesn't need both, quite frankly. Right now, we stress, quite frankly, dry goods. There seems to be a bit of a shortage in that regard and getting this stuff out. And it is a thing that boasts that basically takes care of things so well. And we can get it across the board. It's ubiquitous. Everybody needs tuna and mac and cheese and peanut butter and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So if you pin me down, I would say right now the food donations.
And George Matisik, what do you say?
Yeah, I totally agree with Gerald. And also to his earlier point, one of the issues that we're facing with is not just getting the food in, but getting the food out. And that means building more infrastructure in areas where we haven't had it previously. And that too has an expense to it. So it's not just about getting the food in, but think about all of those different food pantries who we're serving They need refrigeration. We need trucks. We need all of the logistics behind getting the food where it needs to go, just like an Amazon would, right? So just like Amazon's faced with the last mile, Share Food Program and Touch New Jersey are faced with the lost mile.
Yeah.
How do you get out to that last, to the individual at the end of the supply chain to make sure that they're getting food regardless of what's happening at the economic level?
George Matisek, are you looking for people to donate time? And if so, in what ways?
We are. We certainly are. So we still are taking up to, we used to have 40, 50, 60 volunteers a day in our warehouse. We've now had to cut that down to 13 to help us pack boxes in a socially distanced way. We also do a program called Knock, Drop, and Roll, which is a home delivery service that we provide for folks who are unable to get, folks who are disabled and seniors. So we do that on Saturdays. And we're always looking for volunteers to drive on Saturday mornings.
And Gerald, how about your pitch for those who might live in the South Jersey area?
I am right up George's alley there, as I need people in that regards to drop-offs, Saturday mornings, things like that, getting it to people who can't get it or don't have the ability to get it. Driving and logistics like that is always important. Food pantry itself needs people in regards to deliveries. We get huge deliveries and really, really need to hit people at that time. So anybody like that can always contact Touch and we'd be glad to put you to work.
Why did you get involved in this work, Gerald?
It was a need. I had a change in life, and I decided that this is something that I wanted to do. And I think, as George will tell you in a minute, the bar was raised for us in March on that date. It was raised tremendously, exorbitantly. And we're in a position now trying to respond to that. This isn't the time to think about why you got involved, unfortunately.
George, one final question. What goes through your mind when you see such enormous need?
Yeah, I mean, right now, you know, the thought is around logistics. You know, it's we know that there's a need out there, and we can spend lots of time debating how the need arises, who's the fault for the need, and how this all happened. For us, we know that there's a pressing need, and we need a logistical response to it. And so, the Share Food Program is going to work around the clock to make sure that we're meeting that need.
And we thank you so much for the work that you do, George Matisek, Executive Director of Share Food Program. Great to have you with us. Thanks.
Thanks a lot.
And our thanks to you as well, Gerald Davis, Executive Director of Touch Food Alliance of New Jersey. We appreciate the work your organization does as well. Great to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
All right. Up next on the Regional Roundup, we'll speak with Rabbi Yosef Goldman about Hanukkah, which is coming up, but also Rising Song Records. He's co-founder. Stay with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to the Regional Roundup by Mary Cummings Jordan. Sundown Thursday marks the beginning of Hanukkah, the 8-day Jewish Festival of Lights. The holiday celebrates the defeat of a foreign army in the land of Israel over 2,000 years ago. And when Jews reclaimed the Holy Temple in Jerusalem, they sought to light the menorah, but found only a small amount of olive oil. Miraculously, a 1-day supply lasted for 8 days. Hanukkah is typically a celebration of light over darkness, and much of the music we hear around the holiday speaks to this. We thought we'd begin this part of the show discussing Hanukkah as it might be observed in a very challenging year with Rabbi Yosef Goldman. Rabbi Goldman is also a musician and co-founder of Hadar's Rising Song record label. We'll also listen to some of the label's original Jewish devotional music, including some of Goldman's work, whose soundscape at times reflects a wide-ranging influence. Rabbi Yosef Goldman, welcome to the Regional Roundup.
Thank you, Mary. It's so great to be here.
Well, let's begin with the holiday coming up. Again, according to the Jewish faith, Hanukkah is the celebration of a miracle. And yes, we are nearing the end of a tumultuous year. So the first question is, how are you approaching Hanukkah this year?
Thank you. In addition to the practices that we will be doing at home, so much of the practices of Jewish ritual life have moved into the home, even if they would otherwise have been in the public sphere. So in addition to our practices at home, there's going to be, like so much of Jewish life and faith life these days, it's going to be practices online as well. We're going to to celebrate the holiday with the virtual communities that have augmented the communities that that we've been missing in person.
How do you celebrate? I guess using the word celebrate and celebrate all, you know, indicates joy during a really rough year. How do you approach that?
Well, when our rabbinic texts talk about the period of religious persecution under the Assyrian Greeks, a time during which we were banned from Jewish practice and Torah study, and the Holy Temple lay empty and desecrated, the rabbis describe this as an exile. The Jews were dislocated from the space that was the essential heart of our spiritual and social lives. In this period of pandemic, it's been one of exile for us in many ways. So many of us are dislocated and alienated from the people, the places, structures, and rhythms that give our lives meaning. We just heard your previous guests talk about food insecurity.
Yeah.
We've also been dislocated from our social structures, security of income and home, from our spiritual communities and public observances, from the touch of loved ones. And Hanukkah during the pandemic reminds us that there can be seeds of light and hope amidst the darkness of ongoing suffering, of loss and grief. And the resilience, creativity, and kindness and pure heart that has emerged from the terrible hardship of this time has been amazing. And that, to me, is the light of Hanukkah this year.
We're going to talk about your upcoming podcast and the first episode, which will focus on Hanukkah in just a bit. But first, Yosef Goldman, let's talk about your album, Open My Heart, which is part of the Rising Song label. You describe this work as original Jewish devotional world music, and we've got a clip of your song, Ein Od. So let's have a listen. Love your voice, first of all. And tell us what we're hearing here and what the musical influences are in the song.
Sure. Hearing a setting of texts that come together from the Deuteronomy, from prophets, come together in the liturgy to talk about the oneness of God. In O, there is none other than you. And it's a meditation on bringing an awareness of the unity of the divine into our hearts, an awareness that is deeper than any intellectual knowledge that we could attain. What we're hearing is a lot of kind of call and response chanting and instrumentation that includes electric guitar and oud and Turkish instruments of tambour and kamanche. And of course, since it's Rising Song Records, lots of vocal harmony. It represents a lot of my musical influences, including the music of my Mizrahi roots, my Yemenite and Syrian Turkish family, as well as the devotional music outside of the Jewish world that has meant so much to me in my spiritual development, the music of Sufi Islam, the Qawwali music of artists like Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan.
So, how did you go outside, I guess, your home influence, your Jewish musical influence, to embrace these other influences? And, you know, especially are you getting a little pushback from perhaps some of the more orthodox communities within Judaism for embracing, say, Sufi chanting, which is connected to Islamic mysticism?
That's a good question. I grew up orthodox, and certainly in the circles, the modern Orthodox circles that I grew up in, it was not common to listen to music, especially sacred music from outside sources. Though in the modern Orthodox world, there is openness to definitely cultural influences, certainly, and also some spiritual influences. But on my journey, I was a rabbinical student in the Orthodox world before having some life experiences that led me to take a break from that path and explore beyond the community in which I was raised, and spent time making music and teaching and praying in communities of every Jewish movement, and also seeking influence and wisdom and light wherever I could find it. And I'd say these days I'm fully grounded in a more progressive Jewish community. So making my music in the context of a community of Jewish artists that are drawing from many different sources. And I have, I don't think that many people in the Orthodox community, partly because my music includes singing of women in addition to other spiritual influences. I don't think that there are many people in the Orthodox community that are listening to my music.
I understand you co-founded Rising Song Records with Joey Weisenberg, and we have Ode Yishma lined up, and this is from Joey. If I'm reading this correctly, the Hadar Ensemble's Songs of Ascent Nigunim, or Ningunim. So let's hear a little bit of this. The sound here seems to be joyful. Translate for us, Yosef.
Yes, Ode Yishma, again, we will hear in the streets of Jerusalem the joyful sounds of bride and groom. It's a text that's traditionally sung at weddings, and it's a setting of Joey Weisenberg. So Joey Weisenberg is the heart and soul of Rising Song Records. Started off as a project of Joey, who is a prolific artist and teacher. Joey creating an album of his original music, Nigunim, which are typically wordless melodies that are sung devotionally. And over time, we built an ensemble. Joey built an ensemble of singers and musicians, and gather to make sacred music that's improvisational and I've recorded several albums before expanding to start recording some of our friends and teachers and people that we make music with together. Mm-hmm. And I've had the pleasure and honor of recording on almost all of the albums with Joey, and then most recent, and I've served as a in many roles with Hadar's Rising Song Institute, which has been founded in recent years, is devoted to cultivating Jewish spiritual life through music. And one of the projects...
Oh, I was just going to...
Rising Song Records. Yeah, sorry.
Oh, no, that's okay. Unfortunately, we're coming up to the top of the hour here, and I want to get some more of the music in. But I also wanted to ask you, Yosef, what can someone who is not a person of faith take from your work?
One of the beautiful things about any music is that it transcends the language. You know, some of my favorite music is music in languages that I don't understand, and also beauty of nigun, which is wordless music, that you don't have to be limited by how you feel about the words. The music speaks to our souls and enlivens us in a way that words alone cannot.
In your opinion, at our essence, what binds us as humans?
What binds us as humans is we share an essence. We share an aliveness that stems from the same source of all. And it is that aliveness that is touched through music, through song, why so much of my work has been devoted to cultivating communal experiences through song.
I understand you are creating a podcast radio show, and the working title is Sheer Bliss?
That's right. Sheer meaning song, so it's a lovely little wordplay. Sheer Bliss, it will be a radio hour that I'll be hosting with Rising Song's Josh Fleet, focusing on different aspects of Jewish music, hopefully unearthing things that might not be commonly listened to by the audience. And for our inaugural episode, we're going to have an hour-long Hanukkah episode of music from Rising Song Records and well beyond, and sprinkled with some teachings.
So what sort of Hanukkah music can we expect to hear? Describe it for us.
There will be... everything from 17th century choral music to some hard rocking music that hopefully you'll hear some of, and some music influenced by trance music and also Hasidic melody, a little bit of everything, hopefully. With the common theme of something that will bring meaning to people's Hanukkah experience.
And I think it's the first live stream is what, this coming Sunday at 7 in the evening, correct?
Yeah, we'll be having a program of Hanukkah music on Sunday night, Mizrahi and Sephardic music, so music from beyond the Ashkenazi world on Sunday. And actually, we have a full slate of Hanukkah offerings. You can visit risingsong.org/events, as well as visit the parent organization, hadar.org, for all sorts of live music, live events, and resources for the holiday.
Well, Rabbi Yosef Goldman, it was a pleasure. Happy Hanukkah, a little bit early.
Thank you, Mary. It was a pleasure.
And don't forget, we are on social media at whyy.org/radiotimes. Our engineer today has been Diana Martinez, our producer, John Ahrens, with help today from Kelsey Hansen. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. We're going to close the show with a Shalom Aleichem from Yosef Goldman's album, Open My Heart.
Shalom. ocean.